Good morning. On today's programme, why couples in Cameroon are beginning to register their marriages, and we hear why the wife of one of France's most notorious serial killers was back in court. But first we go to Poland, and tussles have been taking place between the country's new pro-EU government, which came to power last month, and Conservative President Andrzej Duda. Mr. Duda is widely viewed as an ally of the previous Law and Justice Administration, which had ruled Poland since 2015, but lost last October's general election. The president has criticised the government's recent changes to public media and the dismissal of the national prosecutor from his role, both of which are early moves by the new coalition to reverse the policies of the previous government. From Warsaw, Liam Nolan reports.
I spent a lot of this week trudging through the heavy snow that has covered Warsaw. Each morning, teams of workers cleared the footpaths after a night's snowfall, only for them to be covered again during the day when the next flurry landed. The city can be picturesque but cold at this time of year, as a chilly wind works its way up from the banks of the Vistula River. On Wednesday evening, I made an attempt, in vain, to find supporters of Law and Justice, now Poland's main opposition party, outside the office of public television broadcaster TVP. For weeks, the party faithful and some of their high-profile politicians have staged protests at the offices of TVP, the Polish press agency, and public radio, because last month, the new culture minister sacked the senior management of all three outlets. More than 50,000 supporters of Law and Justice took to the streets of the capital just over a week ago to protest those sackings and other government reforms. But this week, the protesters were not there. Perhaps they had had the good sense not to protest in sub-zero temperatures. For the past 8 years, TVP became little more than a mouthpiece for Law and Justice. International media watchdog Reporters Without Borders described Poland's public media during the Law and Justice years as instruments of propaganda. The new coalition government, led by Prime Minister Donald Tusk, has said that it wants to restore the editorial independence of the country's public media, and has brought in new senior editors to reshape news and current affairs coverage at the three outlets. But Mr. Tusk's government is facing challenges to the changes it wants to implement. Firstly, from Poland's president, Andrzej Duda. Secondly, from Law and Justice supporters. And thirdly, from the highest court in the land. On Thursday, Poland's Constitutional Tribunal ruled that the government's plans to put the three public media outlets into liquidation was illegal. 15 judges sit on the Constitutional Tribunal, all of whom were appointed by the previous administration. President Duda had called the dismissal of public media chiefs a violation of the law. But it's not his only gripe with Mr. Tusk's government, which is trying to reverse changes that Law and Justice made to the independence of the judiciary, of which the European Commission said threatened rule of law standards in Poland. Mr. Tusk's government is hoping that by unravelling the work of Law and Justice, it can unlock billions in EU funding, frozen because of those concerns in Brussels. This week, Mr. Duda criticised the Justice Minister's dismissal of the National Prosecutor, Dariusz Barski, who had been appointed by Law and Justice. He also called for the release from prison of two former Law and Justice lawmakers, including the former Interior Minister, Mariusz Kamiński. Mr. Kamiński and his deputy were originally convicted in 2015 for abuse of power. However, shortly after becoming president that same year, Mr. Duda pardoned the two men. With Law and Justice no longer in power, Poland's Supreme Court, which had originally found Mr. Duda's pardon to be incorrect, sent the case back to a local court for sentencing last month, and the two former lawmakers were duly sentenced to 2 years in prison. In a bizarre twist, on January 9th, the two former lawmakers hid out in Warsaw's presidential palace to avoid arrest. It was only after Mr. Duda had left the building in the evening that police officers moved in to arrest the two men. They have since started their sentences in two separate prisons outside Warsaw. Mr. Duda and Mr. Tusk met during the week to iron out their differences. They agree on matters of national security and supporting Ukraine, but differ on domestic issues. Mr. Tusk said after the meeting that the president had a different opinion on the rule of law than he had, and that Mr. Duda had played a role in the devastation of the legal order in Poland. Mr. Duda has just over 18 months left in his second and final term as president. And until then, he and the Constitutional Tribunal could continue to block any major legislation that Mr. Tusk's government tries to implement. Temperatures in Poland are expected to rise next week, so all that snow will finally start to melt. A thaw in relations between both the new government and the president's office might have to wait a lot longer. For World Report, this is Liam Nolan in Warsaw.
Next, we go to Cameroon, where most couples getting married choose a traditional marriage, which is unregistered. But things are changing. Encouraged by women's rights groups, couples are beginning to marry in official ceremonies in order to protect the woman's right to property should her spouse die. More from Dorcas Akupe in Cameroon.
To go by Cameroon's Institute of Statistics, only 10% of couples have legalized their marriages, with most persons preferring traditional marriages. Observers say the situation is worse in northern Cameroon, that has over 30% of the Central African nation's population. And gender activists say women's right to inherit property are not recognized in traditional marriages. This is what is now pushing more and more couples to marry officially. As a practicing journalist living in northern Cameroon, I have several female friends who aren't legally married, and I have seen most of them traumatized and their husbands' properties poorly distributed, leaving the widow and her children with little or no property. The Regional Delegation of Women's Empowerment and the Family, which is the state's highest institution in the Far North region of Cameroon in charge of family and women's affairs, together with the Mara One Council, has been organizing sporadic mass wedding ceremonies from time to time to encourage many women to earn marriage certificate. During the just ended 16 days of activism, a mass wedding for 30 couples was once again organized at the Mara One Council Hall. Samhana Buba, who is one of the 30 couples who officially tied the knot, has four children and has been married traditionally for 5 years, but is without a marriage certificate. When the Delegation of Women's Empowerment called for registration for a mass wedding, she says she didn't hesitate to convince her partner, and so they got married officially. Samhana says she's so happy to have a marriage certificate. She feels more secured and comfortable being legally married. This lady in her early 30s adds that her marriage certificate will easily help her to reunite with her husband in case he is transferred to another region. Just like Samhana Buba, another couple say they have been living together for 14 years without officially being married and are glad to have finally gotten the golden opportunity to legalize their union. Both husband and wife say it is going to help their children because in case of the death of the man, the children will get their inheritance because the union was legally recognized. We invited our friends and families to come and witness us legalize our union. We are so thrilled to do this after staying together for more than a decade, they told the media. The highest authority in the Far North region of Cameroon, in charge of women's empowerment and the family for the Far North region, Mahatma Sali, says many cases of gender-based violence in the region. And in order to minimize these cases in the region, legalizing weddings will boost women's legal rights. He equally appeals for other councils in the region to help promote mass weddings. Mahatma says it is very risky to stay in traditional marriages in the region. In case one partner dies, the wife with no marriage certificate risks losing all her husband's properties to her spouse's family. He told couples to worry less about expensive wedding dresses or big parties in order to legalize their marriage. Aisa Dumara, a leading women's rights campaigner and national coordinator of a grassroots organization, the Association for the Fight Against Violence on Women, says women's rights aren't respected enough in the region. She adds that the Boko Haram crisis is menacing Far North Cameroon has further exacerbated the situation. The highest authority for women's empowerment in the Far North region says they plan on reaching out to more couples this year to intensify its outreach to couples, while calling on couples who participated in the ceremony to spread the word to friends and family members living in traditional marriages so that women's rights will be respected. For World Report, I am Dorcas Akupe in Mara, Cameroon.
Finally, the case of one of France's most notorious serial killers was back in the headlines recently. Dubbed the Ogre of Ardennes, Michel Fourneret was convicted of multiple murders of young women in the 80s and 90s. His wife was also convicted for complicity in the abductions. A cold case review by French detectives has led to Monique Olivier appearing in court again on more charges, as Rory Mulholland reports.
Monique Olivier and her husband, Michel Fourneret, would often go on what they called virgin hunting expeditions in France and sometimes in Belgium. They looked and dressed very much like a French Mr. and Mrs. Average. Few would have suspected what they were really up to as they drove around in their very average Renault van. They would cruise small towns and villages in the 1980s and 90s and pull up beside a girl or a young woman and ask for directions. The presence of Monique Olivier in the front seat, sometimes with the couple's infant son in her lap, would reassure their victims, who agreed to get into the van and take them to the local doctor or wherever they had asked for. Sometimes Fourneret would rape and kill the girl in the van. Other times he would do the killing at their home, which at one point was a chateau in the Ardennes region, which they bought with gold they'd stolen from a bank robbing gang. The pair were eventually arrested in 2003, and Fourneret was convicted in 2008 for 7 murders and sentenced to life. His wife also got life for complicity. I was at that trial in the town of Charleville in the Ardennes, and I was again in court in Versailles when the macabre pair, by then divorced, were convicted of 2 more murders in 2018. Fourneret died in jail 3 years ago, but the grisly tale continued when his ex-wife was back in court in a Paris suburb last month for complicity in the murder of 3 more victims between 1988 and 2003. Olivier was convicted just before Christmas for helping in Fourneret's abduction, rape and murder of a 19-year-old French woman, a 9-year-old French girl and 20-year-old Joanna Parrish. Joanna was a British student who was doing a year out in France during her studies. The bodies of the former 2 victims have never been found. This latest trial was the result of investigations by France's new cold case unit. The 2 women running the unit were determined to finally give the families of the victims their day in court, even if it was decades after the murders. I spoke with the cold case unit heads. They are examining magistrate Sabine Keris and assistant judge Valérie Duby in their office in the Paris suburb of Nanterre, in the same modern building as the courtroom where Olivier was tried. They told me that it took enormous reserves of patience, a friendly police dog and chocolates to get Olivier to admit to her role in her ex-husband's crimes. The accused spoke to them for days on end, but never on Fridays because she kept that day for watching her favourite French TV detective series, Capitaine Marlowe. The questioning often took place in their offices, but on around 20 occasions, they accompanied Olivier on trips to sites where Fourneret was believed to have buried bodies. There were 10 such trips to look for Estelle Mouzin, who was 9 when she disappeared in 2003 near her home in the Paris region, and a similar number for Marie-Angèle Domès, who was 19 when she vanished in 1988 in Burgundy. But no bodies were found. Madame Duby said that Olivier feels no remorse. She said that one minute she might be saying that Estelle Mouzin was crying out for her mother, and then she, Olivier, would see chocolate and would say, "Oh, that's chocolate for me." Madame Duby said there was no difference between her talking about chocolate or about locking up or kidnapping a victim. Olivier described, for example, how she heard Fourneret beating Joanna Parrish as she sat in the front of the van and her husband raped and killed the English student in the back. But, said Madame Duby, Olivier didn't say to herself, "Oh, poor Joanna." It was, "Oh, poor me, I had to listen to all those terrible noises." Madame Keris recounted how on one occasion they brought a police Belgian shepherd dog into the interrogation room, and this had a soothing effect on Olivier and she began to talk. But even with the help of a canine, it took years to extract from her enough information to build evidence to ensure that the legal case was solid. The case did prove solid, and Olivier was duly declared guilty by the court, where victims' family members had sat through nearly 3 weeks of often harrowing testimony. The cold case unit's dealings with Olivier may not be over. Furnier confessed to 11 murders before he died, but reports suggest that there could have been up to 24 more. For World Report, this is Rory Mulholland in Paris.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.